KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Living in the USA. I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. Later in the show, what the polls and pollsters are missing this year. We'll talk about the political potential in 9 million people who have turned 18 since the last election. 80% of them are people of color. Steve Phillips will explain. His book, How We Win the Civil War, is out now in a new edition, updated for the 2024 election. Also, Amy Willens will report on the big news about Haiti. After gangs took over most of Port-au-Prince, Haiti's acting Prime Minister Ariel Henry agreed to step aside. Amy will talk about how we got here and what might happen next. That's coming up later in the hour. But first, today's political update with Harold Meyerson. Of course, he's editor-at-large of the American Prospect. Harold, welcome back.
Always good to be here, John.
Well, let's start today with news of the class struggle in Long Beach. Long Beach hotel workers will now get the highest minimum wage in the nation. A referendum passed by the voters will raise those workers' wages to $23 an hour by July 20th this year. That's in 4 months, with an escalator to $29.50 an hour by the 2028 Olympics. That campaign was led by Unite Here Local 11, Lane, the LA County Federation of Labor, and CLUE, C-L-U-E, Clergy and Laity United for Economic Justice. Their campaign focused not on TV ads, but on door-to-door canvassing. Canvassers knocked on over 100,000 doors, spoke to over 20,000 Long Beach voters, and also made 100,000 calls. The measure was endorsed by a broad coalition of supporters, including over 200 Long Beach small businesses and 70 Long Beach community organizations. Let's talk about how the Long Beach labor left is pointing the way for other cities.
Well, to begin with, the Long Beach labor left, which I've done some reporting on a while back, you know, maybe a decade ago, includes a number of sort of ethnically specific groups, because Long Beach is a very diverse city. And I, in sort of dealing with some of these same fights, but in their iteration of a decade ago, I remember dealing with Cambodian community groups and I think a Samoan community group. So it's a very, in basic LA fashion, a very diverse city where the kind of labor community coalition that the late head of the LA County Federation of Labor, Miguel Contreras, was putting together almost 30 years ago in the greater LA area has really taken root, and those forces combined create a real block, a real, you know, significant share of the Long Beach electorate. It includes, you know, some Jewish groups, and I bring that up because my Aunt Harriet, who died earlier this year, just a few weeks short of turning 100, had testified on behalf of the hotel workers around 3 or 4 years ago, which I remember because this was one of those city council meetings that had hundreds of workers and their supporters in attendance. And so the then mayor, who I believe is now the Congress member, Robert Garcia.
Yes, Robert Garcia, elected to Congress from Long Beach in 2022. Before that, mayor for 8 years. He was the city's youngest mayor. He was the city's first openly gay mayor. He was the city's first Latino mayor. And in Congress, he's the first Peruvian American member of Congress, Robert Garcia.
The then mayor limited everyone's speaking time to 2 minutes. But when my aunt came forward, he said, you know, forgive me for being rude, but looking at her, may I ask your age? And she said, well, I'm 96. And he said, okay, you get 3 minutes. So this was my aunt testifying on behalf of the group of workers whose own power and own organization combined with that of the greater Long Beach community got them something which is really significant.
Next topic, Big Pharma. I understand that drug companies are fighting Biden's efforts to lower their prices. Now, by itself, that's not surprising, but it has political implications for the Democrats. First of all, I understand from your new piece at prospect.org that Big Pharma told the court that cutting drug prices is unconstitutional. I know that the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law abridging the right of the people peaceably to assemble, but it doesn't mention a right of the drug companies peaceably to raise prices, or is that something I missed?
Well, everyone missed that, including the people who authored the First Amendment. I think that is what's called a spurious claim. It just shows you the way in which drug companies want to keep the status quo, in which residents of the United States pay anywhere from 3 to 10 to 20 times what residents of just about every place else pay for the same drugs. Because in other countries, the government negotiates or simply with the drug companies or simply sets the prices. In this country, as part of the Inflation Reduction Act, Biden and the Democrats in Congress got put into law a provision enabling Medicare to negotiate with companies for just 10 drugs. But this is a fight, you know, if the drug companies want to be complete jerks on this, which they show every sign that of wanting, in fact, to do, this is a fight that, you know, we and the Democrats should relish, because it's very hard to find actual living and breathing Americans who would be on the drug company's side here. And Biden, in his State of the Union address last week, said that if he's elected to a second term with a Democratic Congress, he wants to expand those 10 drugs to 500 drugs and to kind of put us on par with the rest of, you know, the civilized world as we know it.
What do you suggest we do about this opportunity, let's call it, beyond talking about it on this show? What do you have in mind?
You know, I mean, I'm sure as the election draws nearer that both the Biden campaign and the campaigns for Democratic House and Senate members will highlight this issue. But, you know, we don't really have to stop there. It strikes me that this is an issue that can really unite, you know, left-wing voters and moderate voters. And so, you know, it's a sort of thing that I think somebody, I'm not quite sure who, you know, you could begin with AARP and local Democratic organizations, but should, you know, hold rallies, you know, either in the courtrooms where these drug companies are making these absurd claims, or pharmacies or parks or streets or any place, really, because, you know, this is an issue that I think most people will recognize which side they are on. And it is, you know, broadly speaking, if I may say this, our side. And we should just get out and push the issue.
I was going to suggest demonstrations at the corporate headquarters of drug companies, but I believe most of Big Pharma has moved their headquarters to Ireland and other lower tax places.
Well, they've moved their tax liability to Ireland and Switzerland and things like that, but they still have offices around the country. But, you know, I mean, really, this could be done outside any drugstore, in any park. The actual sites of the highway robbery that is inflicted on people who get prescription drugs, we don't lack for venues.
Now, I want to talk a little more about Democratic strategy this year and about voter turnout. Defeating Trump requires getting a high Democratic voter turnout. We don't see a lot of enthusiasm for Biden, even after his terrific State of the Union speech. And that means lots of potential Democratic voters need to be enthusiastic about other items on the ballot. And that's, of course, why we have referenda on abortion rights coming up in some swing states, referendum on legalizing marijuana in Florida. And we also need exciting candidates or sharply contested races with what should we call them, negatively exciting candidates on the other side. The best example of exciting candidates leading to victory for the Democrats, there are many from the last time around, but Georgia in 2020 is my favorite, where Raphael Warnock was on the ballot for Senate, along with John Ossoff and Stacey Abrams for governor. Democrats won the state for both Warnock and Ossoff, and also for Biden. And you may remember the margin there was 11,000 votes.
Yes, for some reason that has been drummed into our memory by Donald Trump's recorded request to the Georgia Secretary of State to find that number of votes so he could win the state.
But this year, Georgia doesn't have an exciting race like that with first time you could ever elect a black to the Senate from Georgia since Reconstruction. So looking for other states, it's been suggested that Democrats have a better opportunity in North Carolina. North Carolina, Biden lost in 2020 by only one percentage point. It was his closest loss in the country. And this year, there is something to be excited about in North Carolina, the Republican candidate for governor. His name is Mark Robinson, and he is very much worth voting against. He has, I quote here, the New York Times, a well-documented history of anti-Semitic comments, including Holocaust denial. He's viciously homophobic. He described homosexuality as, quote, filth. And he's a staunch opponent of abortion. He favors a six-week ban. Not only this, the demographic trends in North Carolina also favor Democrats. It has a fast-growing population, especially among people of color, especially in cities in the Charlotte and Raleigh areas. And many of the new residents have come from blue states like California and New York. So how much staff and money should the Democrats put into North Carolina in the next 7 or 8 months?
A lot. I believe the Republican candidate for governor has also suggested at one time or another that maybe women should not have the right to vote. I mean, I suspect that that won't play well with at least a subset of North Carolina voters. And there's a pattern here, which is that in the 2022 midterm elections, on a statewide basis, wherever Republicans ran a complete MAGA nut, as in the Arizona governor's race or other races around the country, said MAGA nut lost, which is one reason why the Democrats did not get wiped out in the congressional midterms, which is normally the case in congressional midterms. So if the party keeps on nominating such folks, yes, that will definitely help the Democrats in general and Joe Biden in particular.
And we have to talk at least a little about the latest news about American politics around what Israel is doing to the Palestinians in Gaza. In the Senate this week, a group of Democrats led by Bernie Sanders, Jeff Merkley of Oregon, and Chris Van Hollen of Maryland are demanding that Biden halt the sale and transfer of weapons to Israel if Netanyahu's government continues to block U.S. humanitarian assistance to Gaza. Quote, the United States should not provide military assistance to any country that interferes with U.S. humanitarian assistance, they wrote. The three of them were joined by Senators Peter Welch of Vermont, Mazie Hirono of Hawaii, and your Minnesota moment, Tina Smith. We thank those six, but it's kind of appalling that, there's 94 other senators, including, 44 other Democrats who did not join them. What do you make of Biden's policy towards Israel and Gaza right now?
Well, it's hard to imagine a policy that is more self-subverting and more contradictory. We clearly want to do everything we can to save the Palestinians in Gaza from starvation. We committed to, rebuild Gaza, and we're also providing the arms by which Israel is destroying Gaza in very literal terms. I mean, I think I've seen a figure that more than 70% of the buildings of any kind in Gaza have been either damaged or leveled. And I equated this in one piece I wrote to an algebra problem I had, in my misspent youth. Yes. The problem we were asked to solve was about a bathtub, which a tap was filling at a certain rate and a drain that was open was draining at a certain rate. The Biden policy towards Gaza is really the kind of the same as that bathtub. We're filling it and we're draining it simultaneously. I think increasing number of Americans can't understand why we are still not putting conditions on our assistance to Israel. I mean, not only are they wreaking havoc in Gaza, you know, killing tens of thousands of Gaza residents, now not only from direct military force, but from starvation as well. But the Israeli government of Bibi Netanyahu is dead set opposed to what has been our position, and historically before Netanyahu, the Israeli position for how to deal with the larger question, which is to have a two-state solution. Why then we're not putting any conditions on our aid to Israel is a mystery, and B, I think something that hurts Joe Biden in the upcoming election, not just among supporters of Palestinians, but among simply growing numbers of Americans looking at this and say, why are we doing this?
And finally, it's time for your Minnesota moment, news from my hometown of St. Paul that you won't get from Sean Hannity. Harold, the American Prospect website, prospect.org, posted on Wednesday your long-awaited piece, if I may call it that, Turning the Tables in Minnesota, an enduring union community alliance in the Twin Cities, may be a model for progressive victories. We talked about this a little last week, but tell us more about the kind of model that the Twin Cities labor movement has presented.
One of the basic rules of politics is if you want to build a constituency and win it, you've got to keep engaging. You can't just show up at election time. And in Minnesota, a little over a decade ago, a number of unions and a number of community groups said, let's keep meeting. They call this a table, and see what we have in common and see what fights for other issues like better schools, et cetera, we can fight together on. And let's support each other when we have our own demands. And so the week before last in Minnesota, or actually last week in Minnesota, now that I think of it, a lot of unions were staging job actions and strikes. They and the community groups turned out for each other. They were trying to get raises for the janitors union, the laborers union, the nursing home employees, the teachers of St. Paul, et cetera, all working together. And they had devised some ways in which non-union members in those sectors could benefit as well through city and state legislation that they were asking for panels, for tables, again, using that word, that would set standards for wages and working conditions in areas where there's a number of workers who fall outside the jurisdiction of union contracts, be that residential construction or janitorial work. A lot of these groups are immigrant groups, but you know, it was a coming together of all those groups, and they seem to be winning a lot of stuff. So in numbers and in coalitions and in enduring coalitions, there is power and strength.
Harold Meyerson, read him at prospect.org, which just published his big, wonderful report, Turning the Tables in Minnesota, an enduring union community alliance in the Twin Cities, may be a model for progressive victories. Harold, thank you for your Minnesota moment, and thanks for talking with us today.
Always a pleasure to be here, and always a pleasure to visit your old hometown, John.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. Many polls have Biden losing if the election were held today. Four others last week had him slightly ahead. The Kaiser Family Foundation poll showed Biden leading Trump 47-44, and that was before the State of the Union speech. Another poll of registered voters by Emerson College put Biden ahead 51-49, also before the State of the Union. Morning Consult had them tied at 43 each. But the pollsters and the pundits are missing a crucial factor, the changing composition of the American electorate. For that, we turn to Steve Phillips. He wrote the bestseller, Brown is the New White, How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New American Majority. He also hosts the podcast, Democracy in Color, and he writes for The Guardian and The Nation. A new updated edition of his book, How We Win the Civil War, is being published this week. We reached him today in San Francisco. Steve Phillips, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, the New York Times poll, regarded by many as the best, had Trump ahead in early March by 5 points among registered voters, 4 points among likely voters. That's the largest lead Trump has ever had in a Times poll. But these categories, registered voters, likely voters, miss something. Young people of color. What are the demographic facts here?
There is no such thing as, quote unquote, the voters. And yet that's how all of these different reporters and analysts in the time perpetuate this myth that there's this huge undifferentiated block of voters who swing back and forth based upon various developments in the news or the economy or whatever. And it's not at all how actual elections happen. 80+% of African-Americans have voted Democratic in every single presidential election since we started having exit polls in 1976. And at the same time, the majority of whites have voted for Republicans every single election since 1976. And so the notion that you can just look at the voter without looking at the particular racial breakdown is what is the fundamental flaw of these analyses. What I wrote about in the first book, Brown is the New White, was I tried to quantify what people call the Obama Coalition, I call the New American Majority. It's roughly 75-77% of people of color and 38-39% of whites. That coalition is a winning coalition.
In The Nation, where you wrote about the recent changes in the electorate, you report on the number of new young voters of color who have come of age since the last presidential election. How many are there?
There are roughly 9 million more people now eligible to vote than were eligible in 2020. And nearly 90% of them are people of color. And so this is a result, right, of that the majority of people under 18 are people of color, and legal immigration factors into that in a world which is mainly people of color. And what people don't want to talk about is that the reality of having the country be so racially exclusionary for so long that the country was unnaturally white in the 50s and 60s and before that. So most old people in this country are white. And so a larger percentage of the people who are dying are white. And so you combine all those together, and that today's electorate, there's nearly 80% of the 9 million net new eligible voters are people of color.
What is the Republican strategy towards young voters of color?
The cornerstone of it is to stop people from voting. And so voter suppression, depressing the vote, making it as hard as possible to vote is one critical component of that. So you stop these numbers of new people of color coming into the electorate. And then the other part is to fan the flames of white racial resentment and fear. Talk about, you know, immigration and the border and crime. All these people of color are coming for you and your family. Therefore, you have to vote Republican. And it's those two elements are the essence of what the Republican plan is. Scare white people to get them to turn out and stop people of color from voting as much as possible.
Let's just note that in 2020, it didn't work. Biden, of course, won by 7 million votes. You say there's 9 million more voters now, almost all of them potential Democratic voters. I want to get back to the recent polls with that in mind. That poll that really scared the heck out of all of us was in November, a New York Times survey of the 6 battleground states that showed Trump leading in 5 of them. It also showed support from voters of color cratering. What do you say to that?
So that poll came out and freaked everybody out. It came out in November. It was on a Sunday it came out. And it was right before the elections in Tuesday, the 2023 elections. And those elections completely contradicted what those polls say. And so the polls were saying, oh, there's all this collapse, like you're saying, cratering of support of people of color for Democrats, and therefore Trump is ahead. And yet 2 days later, the Democrats took back control of the state legislature in Virginia, which is a very diverse state and was the literal capital of the Confederacy. That was done with large turnout of voters of color. Ohio, which is a state that had been trending, you know, more conservative, voted to pass the reproductive rights ballot measure with 80% support from African Americans. Even in Mississippi, Presley, the Democratic candidate, came closer than any Democrat had come in ages. And Kentucky, Beshear wins re-election, a Democrat running against a Black Republican and a Black Trump Republican. So if there were any state that were going to prove this thesis that the African-Americans are gravitating towards Trump world, it would have been Kentucky. And yet Beshear, the white Democrat running for re-election, actually increased his vote in the blackest counties in the state. So all of the actual election results are running contrary and contradicting these polls. And yet, because it has the New York Times banner, we assume that that's gospel truth, and nobody ever stops to question, well, maybe the poll itself is incorrect because the actual election results continue to not comport with what these polls suggest.
At the New York Times, they are, of course, aware of this discrepancy. Nate Cohn, chief political analyst, did come up with an argument about what happened. He said, yes, the Democrats did win a lot of surprise victories in 2023 and before that in the midterms of 2022 and in the special elections that have taken place since the repeal of Roe v. Wade. But he argues these have all been lower turnout elections where the voters tend to be highly engaged, older, highly educated voters. New York Times chief political analyst Nate Cohn says, Mr. Biden's weakness is almost entirely concentrated among the less engaged, less educated segment of the electorate, including young Black and Hispanic voters. These voters don't participate much in special elections or the midterms, but they do vote in presidential elections. So he concludes, a higher turnout among young voters of color, likely in a presidential election, will hurt Biden. What's your response to the chief political analyst of the New York Times?
That's probably the most nonsensical thing I've ever heard. And it's also completely flies in the face of what all the evidentiary data shows. Biden won young people by almost 30 points. And as I was saying, the majority of people under 18 and those turning 18 are people of color. And so has there been some massive shift in terms of how young people are voting? And no. And so not only that, on top of all of that, I mean, a lot of the young people, particularly young women, post the overturning of Roe, are coming out and voting in larger numbers and voting against the Republicans before the Democrats. So high turnout has never been bad for the Democrats. And if, in fact, there were some evidence that the young people of color were not voting for Democrats and were voting against Democrats, then maybe you could make a logical conclusion of what Cohn is saying. But there is no evidence of that. There's no evidence of that in the actual elections. And even in the elections that did occur, he's calling lower turnout. Like, so the Ohio, the ballot measure piece on reproductive rights, young people and young people of color voted on the progressive side of that. So is he saying that there's some whole other sector of young people of color who are more conservative but not voting, and that they come out that's going to hurt? So none of that makes any sense. And it's completely contradicted by actual voter behavior, and that there's very little that Trump is doing that is attracting young people. He's actually repelling them as he tries to appeal to the fears of older people.
When the so-called experts express doubts about the strategy of maximizing voting by people of color, something the Democrats should do, they point to Stacey Abrams' loss of the Georgia governor's race in 2020. Stacey Abrams, you and I have talked about her here many times, was a magnificent leader and candidate. She had spent a decade on the project that you are talking about, registering, engaging, mobilizing people of color as voters Understanding her loss is one of the subjects you take up in the new edition of your book, How We Win the Civil War, published this week. What's your analysis?
Well, first of all, I went on the Stacey Abrams train for a decade, and so I've seen a lot of the lack of support and, frankly, desire that she fail, and that there's a lot of implications for people. And so there was a very big rush to think, oh, see, Stacey lost. And so, like, it affirms all of this piece. But then if you dig into the actual numbers, so two things about Stacey's race, or about that Stacey's race, about the Georgia race, people like to skip over Raphael Warnock getting reelected. So you have the literal successor to Martin Luther King Jr., the man who stands in the pulpit that King stood in at Ebenezer Baptist Church, winning, I believe it's five elections in like two or three years in Georgia for the U.S. Senate. And so Warnock stands on the platform that Stacey built. And so you can't say, oh, well, Stacey lost and that disproves everything, because Warnock won. And he's won repeatedly, and he has shown that this coalition of maximizing people of color and progressive whites is a winning formulation.
So Raphael Warnock won the same election that Stacey Abrams lost. Turns out that's the problem that we need to understand. What's your analysis there?
What's the biggest difference between Stacey Abrams and Raphael Warnock? And Stacey Abrams is a woman, and Raphael Warnock is a man. The United States of America has never, ever elected a Black woman governor of any state. And that remains the case. And so we can't just ignore that reality of what one of my friends was referred to as misogynoir. And it bears itself out in the numbers, in that Stacey and Warnock got the same percentage of the Black vote, but Stacey got 5% less of the white vote. And that was what the difference is. And so how that then disproves Stacey's theory around you mobilize voters of color, I don't know. The question is, why did that 5% of white voters not also cast their ballot for Stacey in the way that they did for Warnock?
You can read all about it in the just published new edition of Steve Phillips' book, How We Win the Civil War. I want to return to the present and the current presidential campaign. Democrats know that Biden beat Trump by 7 million votes in 2020, but they are worried that the 2020 Biden voters will switch to Trump in 2024, or maybe not vote at all, because Biden is too old. In 2020, Biden won Black voters by a 75-point margin, Latino voters by a 33-point margin, Asian voters by a 27-point margin, according to the exit polls. What do we know about vote switching between presidential elections? How many people who supported one party last time support the opponents the next time?
There is no more vote switching. The American National Education, so this is the point I laid out in the Nation column that I wrote about how Biden actually should be being seen as the front runner. And so this constellation of political scientists that do the regular polls that analyze elections, and everyone agrees that this is the gold standard. And I reprint this poll in the latest Nation piece. The percentage of voters who are swing voters has dropped almost to like 5% of the voters. And that there was a quote in the, let's see, it was a different New York Times reporter was quoting the director of Monmouth University's Poll Institute, said they're asking who the swing voters are. He says, do you want me to name them individually? Because I probably could at this point. So there are not swing voters in any meaningful sense. The real issue is, are people going to come out and vote? Period. That is does remain the Biden campaign's challenge, both in terms of enthusiasm as well as in terms of the voter suppression that we have to deal with.
I'll just add, the people who call themselves independents, turns out almost all of them vote the same way they voted last time.
Exactly.
They like to think of themselves as independent, but really they're either Democrats or Republicans.
The label belies the actual behavior. And so the assumption is, oh, they're independents, they swing back and forth, but they don't.
So it's 8 months till election day. Biden went to Georgia after the State of the Union speech on Thursday. Georgia's largest political action committees representing communities of color endorsed him and pledged $30 million to mobilize communities of color to vote in 2024. This is the Collective PAC, African Americans, the Latino Victory Fund, and the AAPI Victory Fund for Asian Americans. Seems like you're not the only one who has this idea.
I think people get it. They're starting, there's a larger percentage of people are actually getting it. It does still remain the point that Democrats and even the Biden campaign needs to be pushed on, is that when Obama won places like Florida and even Ohio, he had 1,000 people on the ground going door to door in every single county. And so is the Biden campaign going to staff up and scale up and invest in places such as Georgia? And I've heard some things that some of the top Democrats are not prioritizing Georgia in a way I can't even understand. So that needs to be something that we continue to push and pressure on the administration.
Steve Phillips, his book, How We Win the Civil War, is out this week in a new edition for the 2024 election. And he wrote for The Nation about how Biden can win. Read him at thenation.com. Steve, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me, and I enjoyed it.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. Haiti is front page news this week. For that story, we turn, of course, to Amy Willens. She's written two books about Haiti, most recently the award-winning Farewell Fred Voodoo, and before that, The Rainy Season. She was also Jerusalem correspondent for The New Yorker. Her journalism has also appeared in The Atlantic, The LA Times, and The New York Times, and she's a longtime contributing editor at The Nation. She's also a 2020 Guggenheim Fellow, and she teaches in the literary journalism program at UC Irvine. Amy, welcome back.
Thank you, John.
Haiti has been in what you could call a downward spiral for a long time now. We've talked about it every few months, and there's never any good news. It has no elected government. For the last 2.5 years, the U.S. has supported Ariel Henry as de facto prime minister. Last time we talked, which was a month ago, he had gotten the U.S. and the U.N. to support sending 1,000 policemen from Kenya to Port-au-Prince to try to control the gangs that were wreaking havoc in the capital. I understand Ariel Henry went to Kenya last week to sign the deal. Then what happened?
He went, he shook a lot of hands. He looked extremely presidential. Meanwhile, the whole country was exploding. And then Ariel Henry made the mistake of going to the United States before he went back to Haiti. While Haiti was in the throes of terrible unrest in the capital, everybody in the prisons left the prisons, fighting in the streets, burning of buildings, attacks on Haitian police officers. And so Ariel Henry tried to get back into Haiti. And the gangs who are running Haiti right now from the streets don't want Ariel Henry on the premises. So they went to the international airport. They shut it down and they shot at it and burned parts around it. And then the Dominican Republic, which shares the island with Haiti, said they would not allow Ariel Henry's plane to land in the Dominican Republic. A decision made, supposedly, I have heard, while the plane was landing. And the plane had to then lift itself up from its landing pattern. And it went to, they decided to go to Puerto Rico, an American-held territory, as we all know. And that's where he is now.
What do we know about the situation in Port-au-Prince today? We're speaking on Monday afternoon.
Well, everything's in a situation of both violence and stasis. Right now, today, there's a big meeting in Jamaica of CARICOM. It's a Caribbean trade organization that includes almost every state in the Caribbean, including Haiti. The Americans are going to be there, Anthony Blinken. Meanwhile, in Port-au-Prince, prisons have been opened. The prisoners have left. A lot of those prisoners were put in there as leaders of various gangs or assistant leaders of various gangs. So this is a lot of heavy hitters who got out of prison, as well as the usual run-of-the-mill person who was never even charged with anything. And there in the streets, police headquarters are under siege by the gangs. And the gangs have sort of come to various coalitions that are now attempting to wield political power.
I understand there's an alliance of nine gangs called the G9, and they have a leader.
Well, that is Jimmy Cherizier. His nickname is Barbecue. He claims that's because he likes to grill, but other people think it's because he likes to burn things down and burn up people. And he's been, you know, in charge of this criminal kidnapping gang for a long time. A lot of people want to portray him as a revolutionary left leader of the Haitian people. I question this, but that is how he also wants to portray himself. And he would dearly love to be president of Haiti. I thought so for when he first started appearing on the scene. But he's guilty of so many crimes, and his gang is guilty of so many crimes. I don't know that he really commands the Haitian people the way he says he does. Just a few months ago, there was a movement called Bois Calé. Bois Calé means sort of shaved stick. It is also a synonym for the male organ. And it was a sort of neighborhood groups that gathered to attack gangsters. So I'm not sure. And they did. And they killed a lot of what Haitians call bandits, members of the gangs. At this time, I'm not sure that Cherizier Barbecue really commands the respect of the Haitian people. Remember, too, that the kidnappings were not just of wealthy Haitians, outsiders, clerics from other countries as well as from Haiti, but of the average little person who had to pay ransoms, too.
The Guardian called Cherizier now the most powerful man in Haiti. I wonder if you agree.
He may be, because aside from him, there's one other person, and then there are the opposition leaders. Now, the opposition leaders, some of them have connections to various gangs, but most of them don't have any armed force at their command. So depends what you mean by powerful. If you mean most gun power, yeah, I think that Cherizier has that. There's also the former coup plotter Guy Philippe, who was a participant in the second coup against Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the freely and fairly elected president of Haiti at the time. So Guy Philippe was in prison in the United States for 7 years on charges of money laundering for the cartels in Haiti. And he was in Miami and indicted and convicted and was in prison. And then suddenly, 3 months ago, he was deported by the United States into the maelstrom that is Haiti. And he's somewhat popular himself, and he has a bit of a following. And he gathered together a bunch of armed state protectors of the environment. So there is an armed group that he has at his command, ostensibly.
Cherizier seems to have one eye on the United States. There's a profile of him in The New Yorker, I think last year, by John Lee Anderson, where he described himself as a revolutionary. He said his influences were Fidel Castro and Malcolm X. My favorite quote, "I like Martin Luther King too, but he didn't like fighting with guns, and I fight with guns," close quote.
I just can't tell you how shameless that quote is on the part of Cherizier. Has he fought with guns for the people of Haiti? No, he's fought with guns for the enrichment of his gang and at the behest of forces that are quite obscure, but they're there. This gang participated in massacres of market people. This is not Fidel or Che. They have not threatened the bourgeois elite, as it's called in Haiti. Bourgeois not meaning middle class, but upper class in Haiti.
Yeah, I know he was expelled from the National Police Force in 2018 for crimes that included the slaughter in the La Saline slums, in which 71 people were killed, 7 women were raped, and 400 homes were burned down.
Yeah, that's not my idea of the ideal people's leader. This is a market, the La Saline market. This is a poverty-stricken open market that I have walked through the mud in many, many times. And anyone who would dream of slaughtering them, it was a political massacre because they actually are the people.
This, of course, brings us to the question of the role of the United States. I saw that State Department spokesman Matthew Miller said last week that the U.S. called on Ariel Henry to, this was after he didn't succeed in returning, to, quote, make concessions in the interest of the Haitian people. We are not calling on him or pushing for him to resign, but we are urging him to expedite the transition to an empowered and inclusive governance structure that will move with urgency to help the country prepare for a multinational security support mission to address the security situation and pave the way for free and fair elections, close quote, U.S. State Department spokesman. Your comment.
Wait, can you pick me up off the floor? I've been overwhelmed by a tsunami of dreck. That is political non-speak for we're not going anywhere. We don't know if we've changed our policy. We have no idea what the heck we can do. We don't want to embarrass ourselves by forcing the head of a sovereign nation, which is, by the way, this is the first declaration that they think Haiti is a sovereign nation, to resign. But we want him to resign, but maybe he won't resign. That will be embarrassing. So, I mean, it deserves to be engraved in stone and put up on the front of the State Department. Declining ability of the United States to figure anything out. This State Department has been reprehensible in the whole Haitian debacle. If they had moved much sooner, more would have been done. If they had, as they like to say, put their thumb on the scale earlier, much could have been done. But they allowed and allowed and allowed and permitted this guy, Ariel Henry, to neglect Haitian rule, do nothing about the gangs, or worse, who knows how much he participated. And now the gangs are running the country. And now Ariel Henry doesn't want to resign. And now they're going to let him not resign. And then the opposition won't be able to really coalesce in any way. I think that the conversation in Jamaica, I mean, I'll be delighted if something comes out of it other than barbecue or Guy Philippe recently out of prison in the United States after 7 years. As long as neither of them is at the table or becomes president, that would be good if something could come up from the CARICOM discussion. But I doubt it highly because all the Haitians are now entrenched against each other, the opposition leaders. And then these two gangsters are threatening to become president, and they have some political allies who are speaking out in their favor.
You've said that the gangs or paramilitary forces now hold power in the capital city, certainly. And they did demand the resignation of Ariel Henry. What do they want? What is their end game?
People don't understand this because everybody is always giving Haiti the epithet of the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere. Yeah, but poor nations, as we know, can yield a lot to corrupt administrations. And that's what's been happening in Haiti for years. That's why it's so hotly contested. There are certainly patriots involved in trying to take over Haiti, real patriots. But there are also people who just want to run the customs, to be in control of the transshipment of drugs between Latin America and the United States. You know, these are very lucrative positions, to run Haitian customs and to run the drug trade. And that's what someone in control of the Haitian government, who doesn't have the best interests of the Haitian people in mind, can do. They can become even wealthier than they've already become on the backs of the Haitian people. And that's what they're buying, the presidency and control of law and order, and thus control of trade, both black market trade and real trade in Haiti. Skimming is what they want to be doing.
Let's just talk for a minute about the pro-democracy groups that we've talked about here many times in the past. What do they think should happen now? Are they capable of any political action now?
I don't know what they're capable of. I mean, when I come to look at it now from all that's gone on and all that hasn't been done, and my realization that the United States no longer knows how to or seems willing to put its thumb on the scale of something that appears slightly democratic, non-militaristic, untainted by criminality. I now think that maybe the United States was the only chance for these people, and that the U.S. wouldn't come down on their side. But because this group, the most prominent of which is called the Montana Group, and it's a coalition. Yeah, it's a coalition of many, many groups, at least 20 or 30 groups, which represent a lot of people in Haiti, but it is unwieldy. But they've come out with a transitional plan toward elections. They've come out with a lot of grown-up sounding documents that would be binding on them to move toward true elections in Haiti. And now Guy Philippe, the other gangster who wants to run Haiti, not Barbecue, realizing that the Montana group had all this documentation and stuff they could present, he's come up with his national plan too, proposing himself as one of the three members of the council to lead toward elections. I mean, do you want to trust a guy convicted of money laundering for the drug cartels to be on the council that leads Haiti toward free and fair, uncorrupt elections? I don't really want him there. Also, he overthrew an elected government.
You make a convincing case.
Haiti is original. Anything can happen. They overthrew the French. They overthrew the slave masters. And then they didn't just overthrow them. They took hold of a government and made the actual first Black Republic. So you never know what interesting, fabulous, or slightly insane things may come out of this discussion in Jamaica today and in the future. I don't expect a solution today unless the United States marches in with the Marines, and Biden doesn't strike me as the guy to do that.
Amy Willens, she wrote recently about the crisis in Haiti for The Atlantic. Amy, thank you once again for talking with us about Haiti.
You're very welcome. I hope one day it will all be resolved in a beautiful way and I will never have to talk to you about it again. I'll just go down there.
After this interview was recorded, Ariel Henry agreed to step aside as prime minister after the establishment of a transitional presidential council and the naming of an interim prime minister. The council will consist of 7 voting members, including, we are told, representatives from several coalitions, the private sector, civil society, and one religious leader. Now from the archives, Katha Pollitt on Learning to Drive. Katha, of course, is a poet, essayist, and award-winning columnist for The Nation. We spoke with her in September 2007. Here in L.A., everybody learns to drive when they're 16 years old. You're a New Yorker. How old were you when you learned to drive?
I was 51.
And why? Why did you wait?
Great big feminist that I am, I had always managed to find husbands and boyfriends who would do the driving on the rare occasions when I needed to drive. New York, you don't need to drive.
So I've heard about
it's
that.
You a have big liability to have a car in New York.
And so what led you to take driving lessons when you were 51?
Well, my boyfriend who was driving me around walked out. it was either get my driver's license or give up my house in Connecticut and confess that I was just a chauvinized, helpless, you know, sexist-defied female.
And so this learning to drive becomes kind of a metaphor of your transformation, let us say. And this wonderful essay, which our readers might remember from The New Yorker, has a lot about your driving instructor, who you found to be quite perceptive about you.
He was a wonderful man, Ben. I had had other driving teachers. I mean, I had previously tried to learn to drive and failed the driving test several times. But Ben was really wonderful. He was great. He was like the ideal boyfriend. He was very concerned. He was kind, but he was also sort of firm, and he was truthful. Like, I asked him, well, say I had to take the test tomorrow, Ben, how would I do? He'd say, well, I'd say 50-50, and I write that, you know, those seemed like good odds to me. he was very patient, and he worried a lot about me. I liked him very much.
And he had that one memorable line about your weakness.
Yes, he says, observation, Kata, observation, this is your weakness. And of course, this was true in many areas of my life, that another person would have seen the trouble in my relationship building for a very long time.
And yet you are well known for what a perceptive columnist and writer you are. How could observation be your problem here?
Well, I guess one answer would be that I'm sure I'm not the only writer who can see things on the page that she can't see when she takes her eye off the keyboard. And another answer would be, I think, you know, the personal and the political are related in very complicated ways. And it's very possible to see something in everybody else's life and in society as a whole, and you just don't see it in your own life because you're in the middle of your life, but you don't have the same perspective.
Maybe we should make it clear what it was in your own life that you were not seeing.
Well, my boyfriend was a flagrant philanderer, flagrant womanizer. He always had been. But, you know, so ladies out there, if you think that your man has reformed, it may not be so, and your friends will not tell you. So after that happened, I realized that I needed to become a more clear-sighted person.
And you wrote a wonderful essay about the process you call learning to drive, which was then published in The New Yorker. And you say after it was published, you got mail from a lot of other women.
Oh, yes. I got, I guess, about 40% of the mail was about people wanting to tell me their own stories of how hard it was for them to learn to drive and wanting the name of my driving instructor. The other 60% was people telling me that the same thing had happened to them, and a few people writing to tell me that the same thing had happened to them with the same person. So that was pretty funny.
Katha Pollitt wrote about learning to drive for The New Yorker. Her essay was later made into a movie starring Ben Kingsley as the driving instructor, and Katha was played by the wonderful Patricia Clarkson. We spoke with her about learning to drive in September 2007. That's it for Living in the USA for today. Our producer and social media maven is Renee Reynolds. Our audio editor is Alan Minsky. Thanks as always to Rye Cooter for our theme music, Mambo Sinuendo. Living in the USA is recorded and produced at our Blythe Avenue studios in Los Angeles. If you missed part of this show or any of our recent shows, you can listen online anytime you want at applepodcast.com, Living in the USA. I'm John Wiener. We'll be back next week talking about politics, thinking about the left, and living in the USA.